You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the offices of Cressa, the only global tenant representation firm. This is your host, John Shuhart from Graybeard Coaching, with my co-host from Cressa, Andrew Reinhart, Senior Vice President, and Lauren Rizzo, Senior Advisor. We have a great lineup of guests for you on our show today, including John Zupak, President and CEO of Threat Quotient. Then we'll talk to Jeb Ory, co-founder and CEO of Phone to Action. Then we'll talk to David Levine, the CEO of GeoStellar. And then we'll talk to Sam Pallaro, CEO of Vinga. It is now my pleasure to introduce to you John Zupak of Threat Quotient. John, what is Threat Quotient?
Threat Quotient is a cybersecurity product company. We build a product called ThreatQ, which is described as a threat intelligence platform product.
And how large or how small is Threat Quotient?
We're at 65 people today.
And how did you get involved in Threat Quotient?
So I'm a career cyber startup executive, and I was on sabbatical from my prior company, a company that folks might be familiar with, SourceFire, and I was introduced to the founders of Threat Quotient, which led to me becoming an investor, which led to us deciding to take this thing and try to make it something special.
So where did you grow up?
I grew up in District Heights and finally Upper Marlboro, Maryland, in Prince George's County in Maryland.
Oh, so you're really a local D.C. kid. Do you have any siblings?
Yes, I do. I have a sister 1 year older than me.
So what was unique about your relationship being so close together in age?
Well, we had the classic cat and dog relationship as kids growing up, which is probably not very unusual. Fortunately, today, we enjoy a good, what I would describe as normal and healthy relationship.
So your sister was a year older. Who usually won those cat and dog tussles?
I would say I won. She probably says she won.
Okay, well, that sounds very diplomatic on your part there. Tell us, what did your mom do?
She was a stay-at-home mom. I like to describe it as a product of growing up in the 60s, where it was very typical for most of the moms to stay at home and raise the kids.
So describe your mom a little bit for us.
I always like to describe her as a bit of a gentle soul. So when I've got the calm moments, I like to give her credit for that. She was... actually very artistic, and while I enjoy music as an example, I think I've got the passion for doing things like that from her.
Yeah, what'd you learn from your mom?
So, you know, she taught us how to be patient. She taught us how to be, I think you could say, a giving individual. You know, the softer side of life, I suppose, is the best way to describe it.
So what the heck does patience and being giving have to do with running a cyber prevention or whatever company? How's that play in?
Yeah, I would say it probably, and it has to play in as a regular part of sort of what we do and how we do things. If you can imagine, for those who have ever done a startup, the normal state of play is chaos, change, surprises, crisis, and if you don't have the abilities to keep an even keel, you know, it will get the better of you. So I like to coach folks that even when things are going great, don't get too high, but even when things are getting low, don't get too low. Keep it a very, very even keel, and I think that, you know, in some way, could be descriptive of the word patience.
Okay, well, thanks, Mom. I think that sounds like you have a big debt there. Tell us about your dad.
Yeah, my dad was part of the Greatest Generation. He was an infantry soldier in World War II, eventually became a career Air Force enlisted individual, retired from the Air Force, and moved into the second part of his career as a postal worker.
Okay, and tell us about how you grew up.
So I grew up I like to sort of frame it as kind of an upper-lower class, lower-middle-class, blue-collar environment. It was, you know, we never felt like we ever lacked for anything. In those days, kids ran the streets, so we would go out at 8 a.m. and we would show up after dark. And it was literally a different time, I think.
So you were kind of a free-range kid back in the 60s, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. But I would consider that to be sort of the normal, you know, way people operated back then.
Yeah. What was your first entrepreneurial effort?
Mowing grass at the age of 8 with my pal Mike Albert.
And what was unique about you and Mike's relationship?
So Mike and I, we were the guys that were running the streets back in those days. And, you know, the interesting debates we would have is when we would go on these ventures to mow grass, Mike, because he was much bigger than me, always got $2 for every $1 that I received. And that caused a little bit of consternation, but we got through that.
So the fact that you were paid half of what Mike got, how did that come up or show up today running Threat Quotient?
Well, that's a chip on my shoulder. It's something I have yet to get over.
All right, Andrew?
You mentioned early in the program your friend Mike and other friends growing up. How do you think your path diverged, and why did you decide to go into entrepreneurial ventures when many of your friends did not?
Yeah, I think, you know, when I look back, I am a bit of a different individual based upon sort of where I came from and my background. And I can't really ascribe it to any one thing. I think I've always had high aspirations. I've always had a high work ethic. I can't think of a time I've never really not had a job. And I don't believe I had really a path, but I had aspirations to try to do really good things. And some of that is related to, you know, let's go make a lot of money, but money's not everything. It relates to having a satisfying career. But as I've gotten through many of my roles and companies that I've been part of, the entire experience really is something that matters a lot. And what matters the most is who you do it with. I've learned that over the days.
Lauren?
Earlier you mentioned that you were the first in your family to graduate from college. I'm sure your parents are very proud. Why do you think that you were different there and had that ambition?
Well, it's interesting. That is probably a product of my growing up. I went to the Catholic school system for first grade through high school. And I can look back now and reflect on it a little bit. At the time, I didn't really understand it. But what I reflect on is the fact that that process was preparing me for a college education. It was preparing me to succeed academically. I knew I had aspirations, and I suppose I was smart enough to recognize that college was a path to do that. But I didn't realize I was really preparing for that. It's just sort of interesting how it happened. I don't think I planned on it to happen that way.
So you mentioned earlier you had an interesting job working at that parochial school. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that would be my first job. They paid us in cash with an envelope literally every Friday. $2 an hour is what we earned, and at the school, the associated residents for what were the Brothers of Holy Cross needed somebody to come in and wash dishes and clean plates and sweep floors, and that was the first formal job that I had.
One would imagine the brothers treasured silence. Tell us about a time you might have not lived up to that expectation.
Yeah, I can't recall any other times I've been fired in my career, but this was definitely one of those moments. After being on the job for, I would say, the better part of a year, we realized, myself and a partner in crime there, that large coffee cans that are empty make very good soccer balls. And so we decided, it wasn't a wise decision, but we decided that we would play soccer with the coffee can in the kitchen, and that created a bit of a ruckus, and that resulted in a short tenure of my career at the residence.
What did you learn from that you apply to work today?
Probably nothing. Just don't kick coffee cans.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that your mom was a musician. How did that contribute to your growing up and your passions today?
So, I believe actually there's this kind of right brain, left brain inclinations and skills that people have. Some people are good mathematicians. Some people are good musicians, as an example. And in her case, she was actually an accomplished violinist throughout high school. And I just think that there's something in the gene pool. I know in my case, and I look at others in our family, my son's a great example. Not only do we have, I think, a bit of a, certainly a high level of interest in music, but a little bit of an ability and a skill in that area. And I sort of point to my mother and what she had.
And what do you think she would say about your role at Threat Quotient?
Oh, she would be thrilled to death. You know, when I first got into technology over 25 years ago, honestly, my folks really didn't understand what I did, but I always knew that they were really proud of the accomplishments.
All right, thanks. We've been speaking with John Supak, CEO of Threat Quotient. This is John Schuart with my co-hosts from Cressa, Andrew Renart, and Lauren Rizzo. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. What's your website?
Yeah, you can find us at threatq.com.
All right, that's threatq.com. All right, thanks for listening. We'll be back in a moment. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, John Schuart from Graybird Coaching, with my co-host from Cressa, Andrew Renart, and Lauren Rizzo. And it's my pleasure to introduce to you Jeb Ory, CEO and co-founder of Phone to Action. Jeb, what is Phone to Action?
Thanks, John. It's great to be on. Phone to Action makes software for public policy campaigns. You can't read the news these days without seeing people talking about advocacy and how people think and view different bills. And our software connects people to lawmakers so they can advocate for policies they care about.
How large or how small is Phone to Action?
We have 50 full-time employees, and we're based in Roslyn, Virginia.
How did you get involved?
You know, it's a great story. I was involved and started a series of mobile technology companies in the late 2000s, and I got connected with my co-founder, Jimena Hartsock, who was an advocate. She was running advocacy for a national education advocacy group, and she had a problem. She wanted to come up with better ways to connect parents and teachers to the lawmakers so they could advocate for policies. But back in 2009, 2010, there wasn't easy ways to do that. So she wanted a way to connect people over mobile technology. I'd always had an interest in public policy and civic engagement, and I was running a business that made mobile CRM technology. And when we got together, I realized that I could apply the technologies that we had built at my company to solve this problem that is really a big societal problem, is helping people weigh in on issues that matter to them. So we came together and formed Phone to Action.
And where'd you grow up, Jeb?
I grew up in Dallas, Texas.
And any siblings?
I have a sister that's 4 years younger than me.
Okay, and what was your role to your sister?
Well, I was the big brother, like John mentioned earlier, sometimes there's a little bit of cat and mouse there, or dog and cat, but the role changed. My father passed away when I was 11, when she was six, and that, you know, forced me to grow up a little bit faster and try to play a little bit more of a mentoring role to her.
Yeah, you mentioned your father and your mother came from different religious backgrounds. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So my dad was a Southern Jew from Dallas, actually, and my mother was a Southern Baptist from Asheville, North Carolina. So they came from very different backgrounds, and they actually eloped to get married.
Wow. So, but they were both Southern, though, right?
They were both Southern.
They had the same accent, hopefully.
Well, the North Carolina draw is a little different from the Texas draw.
But. All right. And what'd your dad do?
My dad was an attorney. He worked in the Department of Justice in the 70s, and he was very focused on prisoners' rights and things like that.
So how do you think that your dad's being an attorney with DOJ and focusing on prisoners' rights, how do you think that translated to what you do today?
You know, I don't think it was direct. My mother and father gave us everything that we needed to grow up, growing up in Dallas. And they always prioritized our education. So I ended up going to a middle school in Dallas, Texas, a private school that my father had always wanted me to get into. It was a school called St. Mark's. He passed away right after I got into that. And I think that what I learned and took away from my father is that, you have to apply yourself, and what you do may not always be may not always come easily, but if you continue to work hard and find an angle with something, you may be able to find success.
Okay, let me ask you one question about St. Mark's. I mean, that's probably the most elite school in Dallas, one of the most elite schools in the country. How did you get involved in public policy with that background?
Well, you know, it was more the humanities. I remember in fifth and sixth grade, take liberty here. I'm going to call Japanese class humanities. So it was the early 90s, and there was a time when Japan was the ascendant power. And I remember studying Japanese in fifth and sixth grade. The program only lasted a couple of years after that. But that exposed me to a much larger world where, really forced me to look at why are we learning Japanese instead of Spanish or some other language that may seem more imminently practical? Well, it's because Japan was this rising power. And I think that helped open up some of the outside world to me. And then, you know, my mother and father were always, had magazines and newspapers around the house and encouraged reading from a very early age.
Your mom was left with two young kids. I'm sure that was pretty tough. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah, so my mother was the first person in her family to complete college. She was the first class of women to graduate from UNC Chapel Hill in the early 70s. And she became an educational diagnostician. She was a teacher at the time after when my father died. And from her, I learned self-reliance. I mean, it's not easy to raise two kids with a normal family, you know, with two parents, much less one. And then having to juggle inflows, outflows, private school, public school, things like that. So I tried to help my mom as much as I could. I don't know how much help I actually was, but I was aware from an early age of the impact of family finances and what kind of decisions where, you know, what kind of activities I did and what impact they had on our family. So it was something I was always cognizant of.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, Lauren?
What was your first job? You'd mentioned something about refereeing young kids.
Yeah, so the first job that I had that was like a more conventional was, I'll talk about some other entrepreneurial ventures I had, but when I was 13 and 14, I worked at a summer camp, actually at St. Mark's as a camp counselor. But then as soon as I turned 14, 15, I was able to become a referee at a local YMCA. And I found out a hack there. If you were the sole referee, you got paid double. So I made sure to pick classes or pick games that were not at great times when I could be the only ref, and I would make $12 to $14 an hour. Usually they were the girls and boys soccer, like 5, 6, 7-year-old range.
So what is the similarity between coaching 5 and 6-year-olds and running a company of adults?
It's also kind of like raising a kid. I have a 2.5-year-old daughter that I see some similarities in coaching and refereeing. What you have to be really careful about and what you notice in soccer, 5 and 6-year-old soccer, is that everyone will run, all the kids will run to the ball when someone is kicking the ball or whatever. So when you're running a startup, you can't let that happen. If everyone swarms the same place, you're going to miss a bigger opportunity and you're going to lose focus. So I think that, you know, observing and understanding how people need to have their lane and they can be most successful there is a, you know, a good takeaway from 5 and 6-year-old soccer.
Andrew?
You talked earlier about your father's loss, and it seems like your mother was very supportive and you had a warm household. But how did you fill that void in terms of having a male role model that could help you, in business and sort of guide you through different issues as you grew up?
That's a great question. I drew on a couple different family members. My uncle, Ray Carroll, played a very valuable role and stepped in and really helped us out after my father died. He got us our first Mac Classic, and I remember some fond memories of that. I looked and found some great mentors along the way. One of them was my former boss at a marketing company I worked for in Chicago, Mike Duty. Mike is now running the company. He was the head of sales when I was there, and he really took me under his wing, and he taught me everything that I know about sales management and how to work with the entirety of a business to be able to achieve a goal.
And what's your website address, Jeb?
phonetoaction.com.
So that's phonetoaction.com. We've been speaking with Mr. Jeb Ory, CEO and co-founder of Phone to Action. This is John Schuhart with my co-hosts from Cressa, Andrew Renart, and Lauren Rizzo. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, John Schuhart from Graybeard Coaching, with my co-hosts from Cressa, Andrew Renart and Lauren Rizzo. It's my pleasure to introduce to you David Levine, CEO of GeoStellar. David, what is GeoStellar?
We're a solar energy platform. We help homeowners, commercial property owners, and others switch from old-style dirty electricity to more affordable, clean solar energy.
How large or how small is GeoStellar?
We have 35 employees, and we're based in Martinsburg, West Virginia.
All right. How did you get involved with GeoStellar?
I founded the company in 2010. I had been working for a geospatial analysis company out of Chicago that was doing acreage and yield models off of satellite imagery. And one of our customers suggested to me that there could be a lot more value in energy analytics than soft commodities analytics. So I quit my job and started this company.
And where'd you grow up, David?
Bethesda, Maryland.
And any siblings?
I have an older sister, Jane, and a younger brother, Danny.
So you were the middle child. What was it like being the middle child?
I was classically rebellious, and sort of like Jan on the Brady Bunch.
Okay, except he's not blonde. He doesn't have long hair, just for the folks at home. Tell us about your folks. What did your dad do?
My dad was an epidemiologist at the Public Health Service. Now he teaches epidemiology as he's retired from government. And my mom was a very successful photographer and photo editor in the D.C. area.
You said earlier, you said you were raised by scientists. What does that mean?
Well, we were my mom started actually as a geography teacher, but we were a very classically liberal, argumentative, intellectually curious family. Most of my early childhood memories were my dad passing books to my sister, who would then pass it to me. We traveled a lot. My dad is an epidemiologist. We would go to Africa and collect serum samples. And I just remember, you know, all my memories were carrying styrofoam boxes with dry ice through airports, which you can't really do anymore.
All right. Where did you find an inspiration to do things that were geospatially enabled?
Well, I've always had something of a messianic complex. I really just wanted to do something important. I've also been very interested in the environment and environmental sciences. And it was clear that about 10, 15 years ago that the most interesting technologies were coming out of NASA, all involving satellites and airplanes. So I started putting a couple of things together. I actually was the executive director of the National Technology Transfer Center for 2 years and just saw all of these technologies, and I started figuring out how to put them to use.
Going back a little, tell us about your first entrepreneurial experience or endeavor.
Well, it was by accident, like most things in my life. I had a band. We toured a lot. And to pay the rent when we weren't on the road, I was editing books at the World Bank. And my boss at some point said, hey, can you figure out how to put these books on the information superhighway? I think I was the only World Bank contractor at that time that had an internet account. So I opened up the office in the evenings for a friend of mine, Steve Shapiro, who was still in high school, and we figured out how to configure Spark servers and publish things on, at the time, Gopher, before there was even a browser, and that really wound up becoming my first real startup, which was Husky Labs, a web development firm.
Something about juggling.
My very first entrepreneurial endeavor was called Juggle or Not. In junior high school, I actually learned to juggle fairly early because my mom gave me a juggling kit and said, this was when I was probably 5 or 6, that she was going to send me away to the circus. And I thought that was a great idea. So I started really practicing. And when my friend Kevin Burkhart, he also learned to juggle, we did birthday parties, and then we wound up juggling in Georgetown in front of a ice cream store, Coney Island, for tips.
So how did working for tips, especially juggling in public, how did that, or how does that translate into starting up a company and running a company?
Well, I really see being an entrepreneur as avoiding work. It's the most miserable years of my life were the 5 years where I worked for other people. And you really, someone told me something recently when, you know, I said, well, if it wasn't really hard, everybody would do it. And she said, well, if it's really hard, you're doing it wrong. And I really thought that was right. I mean, it's the whole idea is to make it easier and easier to do the things we do and work with other people to help them make it easier.
Well, you talk about make it easy, but I'm guessing as a CEO and founder of a company, you work a fair number of hours a day.
I do. One of the things that's bothered me most in my life is that I found I'm actually really good at business. I can read long, complicated financial transaction documents and structure deals, work with employees, and all of those things have become very natural to me, but I really had no interest or respect for the business world when I was growing up.
So it sounds like in some ways running a business and founding a business is almost like a hobby and a fun activity. Is that
fair? No question. I mean, it's really never about the business. It's always about the topic and the intellectual curiosity. I'm fascinated by the transformation that's happening with renewable energy and, you know, globally what has to happen with climate change. So that's really what engages me, and everything else is just to make it happen.
Andrew?
It sounds like you were very influenced by your mother's artistic interests, and that was your real passion, not so much business. How did those skills, or what were the skills that you learned through your band and touring and managing, you know, different bookings, et cetera, how did that translate into your business life?
Well, I found it really is all communications. I mean, that's everything. Learning after being part of my third venture back company now, you know, I found for years I still had that big chip on my shoulder as the rebel hero. You know, I did not want to listen to our investors from these big funds out in Silicon Valley or big companies like Cisco and Intel. You know, I was always right, they're always wrong. And I finally actually somehow learned to listen and to modulate my communication so that they became just much more effective. And it really, it's not all that different than being on stage or taking photographs. Or I have my degree is in philosophy, my undergraduate degree, and then I had a fellowship in poetry. And it's really just not all that different.
You mentioned earlier you have three kids. How does the revelation that listening plays such an important role in business translate to being a father?
Well, I mean, I love being a dad, and my kids are the center of my life. I mean, we decided to move out to Shepherdstown, West Virginia when we got pregnant, and we just thought, if we could have grown up anywhere, where would we have grown up? And we just found this little town that we consider Mayberry on acid, and just really love it. So we live out in the woods on the river, and we just try and have the same fun, open culture at home that we have at the office. And we just, you know, there are boundaries, there's discipline, but we try and balance the hierarchy with the freedom and the expression.
What's the similarity between being a CEO and a dad?
Unfortunately, it's very similar. I mean, you know, they talk about people bringing their work home, but they also bring their home to work. And it's the emotional content in the office that's really most important. I spent some time helping in prisons, doing community development. This brilliant facilitator was doing programs in San Quentin, and I learned a lot from that. And what I really learned was that people are people. Buildings full of people, whether they're schools, their offices, or their prisons, are really all the same. And it's really a matter of engaging each individual as an individual, and everything winds up working out. If you're just thinking the whole time, I'm the CEO, or I'm this, or I'm that, then you're really not getting things done as productively as you could be, on the human level.
What's your website?
It's geostellar.com.
This is John Shuhart with my co-host from Cressa, Andrew Renart and Lauren Rizzo. We've been speaking with David Levine, CEO of Geostellar. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, John Shuhart from Greybeard Coaching, with my co-host from Cressa, Andrew Renart and Lauren Rizzo. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Sam Pallaro, CEO of Venga. What is Venga?
Venga is a customer relationship management platform. We help businesses better understand and engage with their customers. We got our start in the restaurant industry, where we help those businesses keep track of what their guests like to eat and drink, how often they visit, how much they spend, and then use that information to improve the hospitality when the guest returns, as well as market to them in a much more targeted, sophisticated manner.
How large or how small is Venga?
We have 15 employees, but we have customers all around the U.S., Canada, and the U.K.
And how did you get involved?
I started the business about 6 years ago.
And what prompted that?
If you think back to 2010, 2011, it was the height of the daily deal era, and everyone was going crazy buying Groupon and Living Social certificates for 50% off their favorite restaurants. And we had a theory that these marketing practices were not sustainable for restaurants. But at the same time, we were encouraged by the fact that restaurants were beginning to get into digital marketing. And so we thought we could create a better marketing platform for those businesses.
Where'd you grow up, Sam?
I grew up in Albany, New York.
Any siblings?
I have a very talented sister who's 8 years older than I am.
Okay. And what was special about that relationship, her being 8 years older than you?
Because she was so much older, you know, I think I had the benefits of both growing up as an only child as well as with a sibling. She moved out of the house when she was 16, and so I think you can't really classify me as either one or the other, and so I have the benefits of both.
Okay. And tell us about your father.
My father was a history professor and criminal rights advocate turned a tech entrepreneur. He read an article about a piece of software that was enabling press release distribution to be accomplished via computers, and left his job to make the entrepreneurial leap.
And what about your mom?
My mom, like John's, was the first in her family to go to college. She grew up in a very working class family with seven brothers and sisters. Her father was a blue collar worker. Her mom took care of all the children. And she was the first and only one to go to college and then on to get her master's degree and become a speech pathologist.
So what do you think you got from your mom?
I think what she taught me probably indirectly was the ability to go out and accomplish whatever you set your mind to, even if there's not necessarily a plan in place for you to do it. And then directly, I think I got a love of and appreciation for food. She was an incredible cook and always valued having family dinners every night.
So did you learn to cook from your mom?
I did, yeah. From a very early age, I can remember cutting my hand while trying to slice a tomato and having to go to the ER to get stitches.
What was your favorite thing to make with your mom?
I think as a child, of course, I loved tacos like every child. So that was what I generally cooked.
Okay, and what about your dad?
My dad, I think, really sowed the entrepreneurial seeds for me. I figure if someone could be a history professor and criminal justice advocate and become a technology entrepreneur, I could do it. And he also made sure we had technology around the house. So he brought home one time a K-Pro computer, which was one of the first portable personal computers. It was the size of today, which was a very large suitcase, but yet it only had like a 3-inch screen on it, and it can only display green, and it can only display characters like the letter R. And so, but nonetheless, with this computer, I was able to learn very rudimentary computer programming, and I would make a program that would draw a rocket ship just made out of the letter R. And I would program it to make the rocket ship, you know, blast off the screen.
Okay, Lauren.
Tell us about your first job as a kid and what you did with your earnings.
Yeah, so I think, you know, my first deal that I ever made was actually with my parents. I was 10 years old, and they decided they wanted me to have a bar mitzvah, which involved me going to Sunday school, which I wasn't that thrilled about. And so I drew up a master services agreement where my responsibilities were to mow the lawn, take out the trash, and go to Hebrew school. In exchange, I got an allowance. And then at the end of the agreement, they bought me a radio-controlled airplane, which is what I really wanted. So I think from that I learned that, you know, through any negotiation, you can both parties can ultimately get what they want.
Andrew?
You mentioned your father was an academic and then made the leap into being an entrepreneur and technology entrepreneur. Did that give you the courage to, you know, sort of take risks that most people wouldn't?
Yeah, I think indirectly it did. You know, I became an engineer and went into private equity and consulting. But in the back of my mind was always the interest in taking the entrepreneurial leap. And I think I learned that from my father.
So what from a model airplane or remote control airplane flying translates into being a CEO of a tech company?
Well, one of the things about flying radio-controlled airplanes is pretty much every time you fly it, something breaks, and you're constantly trying to prioritize which problems you're going to fix next and figure out innovative solutions, because you could go out to the airfield, make one flight, and then have something break, and you realize, okay, how do I get this airplane back in the air tonight so it doesn't ruin my evening for flying? And I think with entrepreneurship, it's very similar, where, you know, you look at your business and you probably see seven different problems, and you have to figure out which one am I going to address first, and how can I do it in such an efficient way to get things back in order as quickly as possible.
You mentioned earlier you have a seven-year-old son. How does being the father of a seven-year-old, how does that tie to being a CEO? What are the similarities?
I think in both cases, you know, you're thinking about something, an idea or concept bigger than yourself, and you know, you're thinking down the line, how do I set, you know, my son or my business up for success down the line? And it's often, you know, you're making trade-offs between short-term and long-term, and but ultimately, it's about, you know, what can I do to help my employees become, you know, better employees and more successful in their career, whether it's at Venga or at their next position. In the same way, I'm thinking about, you know, what can I do for my son now to give him the skills to be able to do whatever he ultimately wants to do.
Yeah. What gets you up in the morning?
I think it's solving really hard creative problems. You know, I think if what we were doing was easy, someone else would have done it, you know, years before we did. And you know, sometimes you look at these problems and they seem insurmountable, but you know, trying to come up with creative solutions to these problems is what excites me.
Okay, what's your website?
It's getvenga.com.
All right, say that again.
Getvenga.com.
All right, that's getvenga.com. We've been speaking with Sam Pallaro, CEO of Venga. Our guests on the show today have been John Zupak, President and CEO of Threat Quotient; Jeb Ory, co-founder and CEO of Phone to Action; David Levine, CEO of GeoStellar; and that was Sam Pallaro, CEO of Venga. I'd like to thank my co-hosts from Cressa, Andrew Renart and Lauren Rizzo, for helping develop our storyline and hopefully delivering to our listening audience an entertaining and educational show. I'd also like to thank our audience for listening. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a radio show. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. Have a great day. Bye-bye.